is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Alex von Goldstein and Pill Eater. We're going to be discussing the film Solo, 120 Days of Sodom. Great having you guys on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Robert.
It's great to be on, Robert, as always. And Pill Eater, I am very excited to talk to you again, and I hope that, you know, this continues and we talk to you more and more and more.
Yes, I'm super excited too.
So you're now an officially regular co-host.
Yes. Yes.
So the film Solo, it's based on the work of the Marquis de Sade and his book, 120 Days of Sodom. I think a good place to get started off is to talk about De Sade and his work, because that's sort of the origins of this. And the original book by De Sade, I mean, I've seen the film, I haven't read the original book, but from what I've heard, it's actually a lot more extreme than the film even. And the film was very controversial when it came out. I think it was banned in Australia. I'm not sure if it's still banned there, but it was, at the time, considered one of the most controversial films ever made at the time. And the book was far more extreme, but what's interesting is the book was written in 1785. What's interesting about this is there's this kind of notion that the culture is getting more and more degenerate and shocking. But, I mean, De Sade's work was written, like, over two centuries ago.
Yeah, really, yeah.
Pushes, I mean, it would be a lot of shocking by today's standards.
Well, you know, people always talk about this thing about how, you know, these women want to show their tits all the time, like, free the nipple. But I heard that in France in the 16th century that women would just wear see-through shirts all the, you know, the higher-class women would wear see-through shirts. So I think the sexual degeneracy thing, at least among European populations, is cyclical. I think we go through periods of prudence and degeneracy as far as our sexuality goes within the Europeans.
I'm not so sure how to make up state either, but I always think it's interesting because I read him in school just for references, and basically it's
the his most books people, or about him.
His books, and one, you know, 120 days in Sodom, you know, the part where it's like, you know, spring, they all meet and they corral until winter, they like, what, rape children on spikes with their spleens. It's almost artistic, but in a way it's like, there's no actual picture of Sade or, you know, what he looked like, but it's out of curiosity that, you know, who really was this person? Was he just like this criminal Ted Bundy, you know, Ian Brady lunatic? Or, you know, was he like this, like, clever intellect? I'm not so sure, and I don't know why history recorded him maybe as the greatest shock artist of all time, but I always think to myself, it's that theme about how far sexuality can go and how, you know, you look at things.
What did Jonathan Bowden say about Marquis de Sade? I know that Matt Forney and yourself had an interview about this.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I mean, so odd, Forney and Bowden. It's like...
Well, you know, it's fun. I have the book, too, because I'm actually the Bowden collector, too. I have some of Bowden's
books. I love Jonathan Bowden. It's such a shame that he's died. I actually met him, like, about him.
A few months before he died.
Oh my God! Wait, just you go on about that in 1 second. I just have to tell a terrible autistic joke, and that is tomorrow when Donald Trump wins the presidency. You know, at the end of Return of the Jedi, when Luke Skywalker looks and he sees the ghosts of Yoda, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Anakin. Tomorrow, I will look over and I will see the ghosts of Archie Bunker, Andrew Breitbart, and Jonathan Bowden.
That's poetic. Yeah, it's fine. No, I think that's funny. I'm not so sure what Bowden would have ever said about Trump, but
he's a Nietzschean figure. Donald Trump is the last stand of identity.
If you read any of his old school books when he wrote it, like in the early 90s, especially Say It, it's just one long, like if he got the typewriter and just thought of every possible thought he could think of.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like funny because Bowden literally says in the book, Say It is important because he disturbs us.
Yeah.
Or like the intro line, as Samuel Beckett has said of Sade, much of his writing was mindlessly obscenity, but some of his descriptions of love and ecstasy were extraordinary as Dante. That's interesting because it's the same thing I was talking about. Is it Bowden, is he flirting with Sade? Is he trying to say I'm the right-wing Sade? I mean, Bowden did drew intense art, and he also has these weird obsessions with, I think in one of the speeches he said he imagines fat people and he wants to shoot a gun and see how the bullet goes through his fat. I forget what speech it was that from, but that was very descriptive about his personality. You know?
Well, Bowden is some of his acting. Bowden is an extremist, and he is a Nietzschean. And I think that Bowden's whole idea was about, or his praxis, I should say, it's about breaking out of the weakness of Christianity, of moral universalism, and attaining the level of higher man. Now, Robert, you said you met Jonathan Bowden. That's incredible. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I talked to him briefly. He's a really great speaker. He has a lot of charisma as a speaker, a lot of insight. But he's very kind of in person. He's very introverted. And keeps kind of a low profile.
Wow. It's almost like he has the behemoth within him. And when he speaks, he lets that fire loose. Like, I've heard that he didn't prepare for his speeches. He sort of just opened up his mouth and, like,
the same thing is with his books, too. They're all just, ramble-rousing about in his own words. I like Bowden because it's like, you know, I think he lied to Johnson. Oh, yeah, I went to Cambridge. But really, he went to, one semester for a school. He never was.
Sure,
it's uncool because he's, he was really a part of the angry young men generation.
Is that, John Osborne? Don't Look Back in Anger or Look Back in Anger?
I have Bill Hopkins' book, The Leap, and I have a signed copy with Bill Hopkins on it. Because Bowden said,
Leap.
And I bought a signed copy for $100.
With Desaad, he really kind of represented nihilism and especially about sexual nihilism in its pure form. He came out around the era of the French Revolution, and I think he was imprisoned by Napoleon later on, and I think he was even executed. But he basically, his whole philosophy is that morality does not exist, that basically you can just do whatever you want, anarchism. And what's interesting about today's society is the sort of dominant values of society have teared down, traditional Christian morality, which Saad rebelled against. He was extremely anti-Christian and desecrated, Christian symbols. But we've torn down, that traditional morality. But we're not, living in a kind of libertine society that Saad envisioned where you can just do whatever you want.
Yeah.
There's these sort of new moral codes about what you can and can't do that have replaced that are extreme, hyper-moralistic.
Well, let me interject here real quick. I was talking to a friend earlier today, and I said to him that all of these Christians are going to shoot themselves – not these Christians, but these liberals – they're going to shoot themselves in the foot in 5 years when they realized that the whole, 10 years ago, their whole argument was against these Christian conservatives. Creationism shouldn't be taught in schools. Human beings were the product of evolution. Well, anyone who's read The 10,000-Year Explosion by Henry Harpingden and Gregory Cochrane can tell you that human evolution is not just, this kind of blank slate thing. We're all different. The three of us on this podcast have, we have different genetic compositions. And, it's funny, in a couple of years, the liberals will realize they had a lot more in common with the Christian moral universalists than they do with the evolutionists, who are probably the closer to the three of us.
I think it's interesting, back on Sade, Bowden said in the book. He said, according to Say, the penis was the X and the vagina was Y in Say's philosophy. I'm not so sure how that can be in, like, liberal philosophy if you were to teach Say in class and say, penis is X and vagina is Y, or something on that. I don't know. I just think it's like if liberals were to translate, say, like I have another book, you know, Carrie Bolton's The Psychotic Left, and Bolton, like, 2-3 pages thrashes out on Said and says that, you know, the Jacobin Party only liked Said because, like you said, Robert, that he just wanted to, like, destroy both the royal class and religion. And so there is this kind of lost in translation argument where supposedly, I guess, the primitive is predates all the rhetoric and social animal, and supposedly we should, you know, I think they said sexual pleasures where all people unite together, and that's, like, you know, egalitarian by nature. You know, it's the resurgence of liberty within our, like, inner primitive
wait,
nature.
Wait, so he thought that people would unite under sexual, like, sexual pleasure?
Yeah.
And well, isn't that funny? That's almost like Wilhelm Reich. That's almost like this sort of Jewish Freudian post-Freudian Frankfurt School thing, where it's almost like, the only problem is the sexual repression.
Accordingly, Sade also said, what does one, when one is engaged in a sexual act, that everything around you give is utter attention. Think only of you, care only for you. Every man wants to be a tyrant when he fornicates.
Yeah.
There's the feminist line at the end, but still, it's like,
like the Wilhelm Reich, like, you know, our only problem is our sexual repression, and if we just unleash the power that's hidden in the orgasm, then we could achieve to utopia.
It's just like a fancy way of saying, I just want to have sex.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the problem, is you have nerds, like, on this kind of, like, these, like, Jewish intellectuals and their repressed nerds, and then these sort of European repressed nerds, and they're both just like, I really want to fuck, and...
Sade also said, I dance with the Jacobin because they cause crimes, not for any political reason else. I mean, that's according to Carrie Bolton said in The Psychotic Left, but still, it's like, right there, you go with the Jacobins because they're the cool kids, and I guess...
Cool kids have sex.
Somehow, I don't know, you get free sex? I don't
know. It is interesting. Maybe, I mean, you know, I remember having some professor in college. I can't even remember for what class or who it was. But he was like, you know, Karl Marx did this, he did that. But at the end of the day, all Karl Marx did was sit in a library and write books and read. And
if you look at Dessaud, I mean, I was reading about him in his personal life. He wrote about these extreme violent themes like sexual torture. And the term sadism is actually named after Dessaud.
Yeah, I mean,
in his original life, he never... Like, a lot of aristocrats were into fencing, hunting, but he wasn't really into those type of activities, like, involving violence and confrontation, like fencing and hunting. But he spent most of his time, like, instead of hanging around his fellow aristocrats, he spent most of his time with prostitutes.
Yeah. I think that's interesting because, you know, I was reading this. Ian Brady, the Moore murderer, he wrote a book. It was published by Farrell House, and it was The Gates of Janus, where it's like, okay, he's still living, and he could die, you know, in the next few years. But still, it's unlike, you know, Sade, where it's like, he did these things because he supposedly had an existential crisis, or maybe he was just dwelling in it because he likes pain and misery. And it's just a really interesting character study compared to Sade, where it's like that, you know, was he just like a young teenager, mid-20s, and basically everyone said, all right, go to the brothel if you want to ejaculate. And he just enjoyed that so much, he thought that was life. Compared to, you know, Ian Brady, which is more like he does it and he likes to kill little children just because he, like, I don't know, it's some getting high off this feeling.
Well, and he's considered kind of a folk hero by a lot of people because he took place, he lived back, like, in the 18th, early 19th century. But if he were alive today, he would be, like, compared to, like, Dahmer.
Yeah.
Dessaud? You think Dessaud would be compared to Dahmer?
Yeah, if you read his books, like the original Salo, they deal with themes like sexual torture, rape, pedophilia. If he was around today, he would be viewed very differently.
Yeah. I mean, the weird thing is, though, is, like, there's that line in Salo, in the film at least, You know, because the film, Pasolini is a very different person than Desaad, and we'll get into this. But there's the line where they say the only, what is it, the fascists are the true anarchists, right? Isn't that a line early in the film?
Or like every man's a fascist.
Yeah, like, so
there's Sylvia Plath said that.
Sylvia Plath.
And there's also every woman adores a fascist. Like, to Nietzsche and philosophy in the film.
Yeah, well, but the whole thing is that, I mean, there's this whole fascist element, and I guess this is in Desaad, but really I'm talking about the film Sallow.
Sallow takes place
in the 40s, in Mussolini's Italy.
Towards the end of World War II, when Mussolini was being defeated, and there was this remnant of fascism in northern Italy, the Sallow Republic.
Yeah, and they, you know, there's the line, the fascists are the true anarchists. And when I hear that line is, you know, because maybe I can go into a little bit of personal history here. In that, for my group of friends and people I hang out with, Sallow has always been an important thing for us. I remember when we were younger, we would hang out and just drink beers underage and watch Sallow and just laugh our asses off at how depraved this movie was and how, you know, we could have fun watching this stuff and how all the normal kids would shit their pants if they watched this. And
I was more romantic during, but I watched avant-garde films, but I didn't watch it in that way.
Okay. Well, when I watched it myself, Pill Eater, I probably watched the way you did. But when I watched it with my boys, I watched it in a kind of goofier way.
The movie I loved was Trash Humpers by Harmony Korine. God. It's relatively new, but it's just beautiful. A bunch of old people going around humping trash. And yes. I took that film seriously. I thought it was like a horror film. I liked it.
Oh, but me too.
You know, like Sallow.
We talked about like Italian futurism on our show. You noticed like the aesthetics of like the palace in Sallow as that Italian futurist style.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, but just to jump back a little bit earlier about Harmony Korine, I think that before the pause, as we call it, took over our society in every way, you know, whether it was in sports or avant-garde music or film or whatever, there were places that one could retreat to that were sort of cleansed of the pods, you know. And the films of people like Larry Clark or Gaspar Noé or Harmony Korine, like, that's where I threw myself, or listening to noise music like the Wolf Eyes or Mertzbau or Derek Bailey or whatever.
I had a girlfriend that liked Wolf Eyes, but it didn't last long.
Oh, well, you know, those girls are probably worth it in the long run. Go find girls that like Wolf Eyes. They're probably worth it, I think. But, you know, the thing is, there was this kind of weird avant-garde place that one could retreat to. And, you know, I don't know, Pill Eater, you know, I think you and I maybe exist in the same milieu culturally. Did you ever listen to the music of Will Oldham, of Bonnie Prince Billy?
No, I don't think so, no.
Well, you know, he was, Robert, you know that guy, Will Oldham, Bonnie Prince Billy?
No.
He's a guy who made, I think people would throw him under the gamut of alternative country. But his music was never like Wilco's. It was never like any of these sort of mainstream artists that you would see in like No Depression magazine. His music was always this kind of weird, transmorphic thing that always had this underlying current of, honestly, a white identity. And I listened.
Are you implying that you see the same thing in the film?
Oh, definitely. And I'm saying this about Pasolini's work, about the work of Harmony Korine, about the work of Will Oldham, about the noise music of someone like Wolf Eyes.
I'm thinking of a film I really like was Begotten. Ever see that one? It was 1990.
Begotten. So that guy also made Shadow of the Vampire with Willem Dafoe. So what's that guy's name? Forgotten who's the director?
Elias Mirheim.
Sure.
Pasolini, is kind of like the general perception is that he made this as an anti-fascist film to portray a fascist as being like a depraved.
Yeah, no, it's funny
and
because
this was the last film he made before he
was killed. Yeah,
he was murdered.
But
yeah.
I can almost tie this whole idea that we're all talking about here into something that is parallel to Pilleater's Asian Aryanism. Now, I don't consider myself to be an Asian Aryanist, but, you know, I am brothers in arms with this man right here, so I will extend his philosophy when I can, right? So the thing is like, you know, what I see in Sallow, this sort of fascist ideology and sexual violence, you know, and I see this in the music of someone like Will Oldham, Bonnie Prince Billy, and this idea of aiming for monarchy and a sort of racial identity. I also see this in Japanese art. I see this in the music of Mertzbau. And I see this in the music of Boris and all these other Japanese... What was that?
Yeah, no, Mertzbau. Yeah,
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a, you know, otaku
or
whatever.
Yeah, I know.
One of my favorite films of all time, and I put this in my top 10, and alongside Pasolini's Sallow, is a film by Nagisa Oshima, who is my favorite film director. And it's a film called In the Realm of the Senses, or Ani no Kurita in Japanese. And that film is very similar to Sallow in that it deals with a kind of duality between a kind of sexual violence and fascism. And I think that exists in European cultures and it exists in Asian cultures as well. And I see that duality certainly.
I mean,
how would you describe Pasolini's ideology and cultural outlook? He was very critical of like consumerism and the influence of Americanization on Italy.
Well, someone said he was like a. I think he might have even said that he was a Catholic pagan. Which I've heard that term ascribed to Pasolini, and I've also heard that term ascribed to Julius Evola.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard people say Pasolini was like a leftist or a communist, but I think a lot of these people who get labeled in with the left, maybe they sort of identify with the left because they see that as a dominant group, but their actual like core values are more almost kind of like a
rightist,
or third position.
Yeah,
it's interesting too because Pasolini. I mean, I was just looking up his biography. I mean, he had an interest of like a 15-year-old who's now like 70 or something. I think
Nanetto Davoli.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's interesting because it's like this young, like you know, in the gay terminology, bear
or
otter.
No, twink is the word.
Pasolini's the bear. The kid's the twink.
Yeah. But I think it's funny is because, but at the same time, the alt-right James O'Mara manor bun thing, where it's like, they it's okay, and it's like they're all in this, I mean, I think of more Pasolini being gay, and I don't know. Maybe, I don't know how much of that really, but, you know, having...
Was Nanetto the one in the opening scene, obviously, the first scene is they line up all the boys and they inspect, like, their penises? Was that Nanetto?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's funny because it's like, it's too weird when you know when he's borderline pedophilia, and it's kind of interesting in that matter.
Well, you would think he would be 18 in the film. Like, I don't know what the laws are, but I would
well, I mean, who knows? I mean, the thing is, a lot of these laws, as far as the protection of children goes, it's more recent. It's a more recent thing.
Oh yeah,
you look
like
at like 19.
Brooke Shields' film Pretty Baby, where she was nude in a bathtub when she
was 12. Yeah, yeah, I mean, this kind of idea, I mean, you know, this is, on this show, you know what I kind of like about this show, not to be too egotistical or something, is that when Ryan England posted a link to our show on YouTube, the All Left Roundtable, he said that The Stark Truth is a show that has guests on that talk about unorthodox topics.
Yes.
And I think that's like what we are. I think we transcend alt-right, alt-left, whatever. I think we're people, we're fearless, and we're willing to bring people on to talk about unorthodox topics.
or eccentric artist.
Exactly. Eccentric artists and unorthodox topics. So when we talk about the sexualization of minors, right, the most unorthodox topic of them all, honestly, it's a more recent phenomenon. When you look at films from the throughout the 20th century, if you are a film fanatic or someone who loves watching movies, like Robert, that was, you know, a film, you know, Pretty Babies, I'm pretty sure that film was directed by Louis Malle. And Louis Malle is one of the best filmmakers of all time. I mean, Elevator to the Gallows and Black Moon and his film The Lovers, I think is beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, you mean Kenneth Anger, right?
Kenneth Anger, too. I think Kenneth Anger is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I'm thinking more of Kenneth Anger, okay.
I love the films of Kenneth Anger. And I love the films of Nagisa Oshima. And in the realm of the senses, there is...
Do you know of Obayashi House?
House, I've never watched that person's films, but you know,
that's like an old Japanese horror film.
I know House very well. I mean, you know, I am in my own way a little bit of a Japanophile, probably not as much as yourself, but you know, I do love the Japanese avant-garde. I do love the Japanese avant-garde. I think they
did a better House is often quoted as a
there is this theme of like attraction to youth, and we've talked about like those films. And there's, like, the sort of attraction to, like, innocence and, like, the beauty of, like, purity. And men have traditionally, like, valued, like, purity in women. Then there's also the theme in Salo and Desaad's work, which is more about, like, corrupting that innocence and, like, destroying and desecrating it.
No, I think, yeah, that's interesting. You know, back on Salo, I want to mention that it's funny is that you have this extreme film, which is, like, violent and kind of... You know, he'll flirt with the whole pedophilia, sadomasic thing. But at the same time, for the liberal audience, he'll say, this is an anti-fascist film. And this is what fascists really want. If fascists rule the nation the next day, they'll be stripping people naked and doing rape riots. I just think that's really absurd. But I don't know. It probably has happened in history. I mean,
I'm sure it has because, like, power, anyone who has complete power is going to abuse that.
Yeah, like Thomas Goldridge is... his one book, Hellstorm, Hellfire, that's often circulated, or even David Irving's Destruction of Dresden. It's just detail of, like, rape riots and destruction. But in the context of Salo, it's like as if you've donned a swastika or a fascist. This is your true intentions, and rather, you know, it's showing the liberal audience not to embrace fascist identity, but rather to the distance it and kind of think of it more in terms of you know, I don't know, but I like the part, too, that it can have a reverse effect where somebody can watch the film and be like, oh, yeah, now I want to be a sadomasochistic fascist, heavy metal. But then it's like, I don't know, I always thought that was interesting about the film, though.
I think the film kind of captures both because it shows there's a lot of sadism and a lot of really disgusting, depraved stuff. But, like, the opening scenes, you see the girls naked, they're beautiful, they're young, they're innocent. And it also sort of captures that beauty as well, so it depicts both sides of it.
Yeah, I mean,
if you compare the Marquis de Sade like to modern figures today, I know Peter Sotos, who you mentioned on our last show, he's been compared to de Sade. He was actually the first person to be prosecuted for child pornography laws because he published. An image in one of his zine magazines back, I think it was in 1985, and he's written a lot of books dealing with, like, rapists, serial killers, and he made this documentary about, like, this gonzo pornographer back in the late 80s who would go around and pick up, like, prostitutes. And
yeah, Jamie Gillis.
All kinds of depraved stuff.
You know, it's funny because eventually, somewhere around the quarter, if you flirt with, like, Salo about fascism and sadism, you know, you'll get into Peter Sotos, where it's this, like, heavy metal, brutal violence thing, you know. It's funny because I guess Sotos comes from that punk rock generation of just total shock art.
Well, guys, you know, when you ever go on eBay and look up, like, you can go on eBay and you can find, like, used socks.
His books.
You can find used socks and used sneakers. And
oh, no, I was thinking of Peter Sotis' books on eBay. They go for, like, $300.
What I'm saying is related, and it's, I want to get in this meta space that we're talking about, and, like, the totality of the meta space that we're talking about. And when you go on eBay, I'm serious, look up used shoes and used socks, and they cost, like, people are selling them, like, buy it now for $75.
I've seen rare Pepes.
Are you talking about, like, the thing, I don't know if it's, like, an urban legend or real, but, like, the whole thing in Japan where you can buy, like, schoolgirls undies?
No, it's like men's shoes. And there is this place that exists in the mind of, like, contemporary America. Or Japan, America,
Sexual fetish?
Yeah. It's like within the most extreme dissidence of like fuck this.
Like
system.
Japan, like yeah. The service is Yahoo Auction. They don't really have an email, but Yahoo Auction. But I kind of know how to work the Japanese Yahoo Auction. And yes, they have and cute, funny, strange stuff. Very Japanese. And you have to understand
but it's in America. It's in America now. Because I even heard Charles Johnson, who, you know, he has an Indonesian wife. You guys know Charles C. Johnson, Chuck Johnson. He has an Indonesian wife, and he's an interesting guy. I like him. We search her. He does good stuff. But he has said, and I take it from him, that we're in this period of Japan-America. You know, like, I know, I respect Ryan Landry. I like the work he does at Social Matter. I think the neo-reactionary movement is...
You know, it's funny. I was listening to Ryan Landry. Is he Winemerica, right?
Yeah. Because it's related to fascism in contemporary America. But you were listening to Ryan Landry Pillator?
What's that?
You were listening to Ryan Landry Pillator?
Yeah. Well, the thing about in Winemerica, I was listening on Red Ice Radio, and he was talking about race play, where basically two couples... We'll say, let's say you have white male, Asian female. White man would be like, oh yeah, I'm a white male, suck my white cock. And Asian female is like, I'm your China doll, I love white cock. And basically they'll do racist sex. And Ryan referenced it on his show and said that. Like, I'm like, that's funny. So I'm writing my book right now, and I actually copied his quote line. So I don't know if I'll quote Ryan in the book. But that's interesting. I'm looking more into race play. I might even do my own race play fiction. For my upcoming book, so
that's a definitely interesting concept because you know, like in Shallow, there is a lot of this sadomasochistic thing.
Well, there is one racial element in Shallow. I think there is like a black slave towards the end.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't recall what. I don't know. That's interesting. You're mentioning it. Funny that bring that up.
Well, the weird thing, I mean, do you guys know the film The Night Porter by, I think the director's name is Liana Calavini. I'm not 100% sure if that's her name, though.
Charlotte Rampling
and Dirk Bogarde. It's sort of like a Nazi fetishist S&M film. I remember James O'Meara. We had him on our show. It was a lot of fun with him on. And he said this funny thing. He's like, no woman wants to be tied up by a liberal. No woman lays in bed at night fingering her twat, about this liberal who's going to fuck her.
That's why porn actresses are going to suck dick for Trump, right? Not
yeah,
like porn actresses.
Exactly. But, you know, and not to be so chauvinistic, because I really don't consider myself to be a chauvinist, but the more aggressive I've gotten, the more fascistic I've gotten, the more I've found women have wanted to fuck me. And I find it to be true. You know, that's the thing. It's odd. It's sort of like, it's this forbidden sexuality is the desirable thing, and it's probably what's desirable with men and with women. You know, a film like Sallow, I think maybe does show a kind of, you know, a sexuality that is hidden behind the consciousness, what we truly desire. Or The Night Porter, too. I mean, maybe we all do want that S&M, because I do find when I'm I remember we've had Richard Wollstonecraft on our show a few times.
Oh, you were in the Hellfire Club.
Yeah, yeah, and he's talked about,
and
he
actually, Pearls Before Swine references Marquis de Sade.
Interesting. But I'm just saying, you know, and I don't want to be too explicit or chauvinistic, but, you know, there is this weird element of women just being like, oh, spank me, hit me.
You know,
me,
it's funny because I was writing something about Octavia Butler's Blood Child. You know, she's like this black lesbian. Yeah. She replaced the Lovecraft Award with her face, you know, most liberal thing. But if you read Blood Child, it's literally like an H.R. Giger style alien that's raping his mom and dad and Sharon. And it's like, but it's sexual.
No, it reminds me of the Japanese stuff with like the octopuses and the schoolgirls.
And it's like, okay, Butler could be saying this is why slavery is bad. This is what white slave owners did to black. But really, in the reality is, are you sure you're not like getting high off the alien doing these sexual acts and we really love that's what, and I think that's what Alex brought up, where what if we paid attention more, we get high off of that sadomasochism. It's like when you watch a silly Holocaust film like the U-Bull, it's like gassing all the Jews, it's like you enjoy watching them getting gassed and not about the message of the film. It was really about the message, you just rid everything, but there's some kind of Schindler's List getting high off of that, and it's like, why can't, you know, sadomasochistic will get high off that? So are liberals really just wanting to get high off that sadomasochistic?
Well, yeah, well, you know what's
kind of telling me earlier, like, there's that film Hard Candy, which is kind of like Solo in reverse.
It's reverse, yes.
Yeah, and that film was somewhat controversial, but at the same time, it's within the politically correct narrative. Because this guy is doing something that's socially unacceptable, and like he's being punished for violating the mores of modern day society, so it fits within.
Yeah, it's like some superwoman or something. But yeah, and it's funny because it's like there's that perverted liberal watching, saying, "You go, girl. Yeah. You show them what they do. It. You do." But it's like you're getting high off that. It's like Sam Hyde during his stand up. They'll be like, "Yeah, Quentin Tarantino, crack that. Show the white man, crack that." You know, it's like, it's so cliche and yeah, so boring. Like, okay, even a comedian can just show you this weird passive aggressive liberal nature. Even like, oh yeah, I want white men dead. Oh, and sooner or later, it's gonna be like, oh yeah, I want white cock, and it goes back to race play.
Yeah,
it's strange.
Yeah, yeah, certainly, certainly.
I don't know. I just feel like some sexual fan.
There's also the theme of, like, being a switch. I remember on our Crowley show with Paul Bingham, he talked about...
Oh, the Anglo.
He said Crowley, so that's uniquely Anglo trait. But I don't know. I mean, the Marquis de Sade was a Frenchman, and he was also a switch. He would sleep with prostitutes, and he'd experiment between dominating them. But he would also get whipped. And you see that theme in Solo. There's a scene where one of the, like... fascist aristocrats orders a teenage girl like to urinate on his face.
Well, did I tell you guys on this podcast about the Muslims and I went to this like S&M place with them?
That's weird. Really? Oh, well, how's it go?
Well, I was hanging out with these Muslims and they were like, "Oh, we want to go to this bar. It's really cool." And I was like, "Oh, whatever." And and they went downstairs, and it was a goth club, and I was like, "Oh, this is odd, all these guys in leather chaps." And then this Muslim, he takes off his shirt, and he pays $5, and then he gets whipped by this dominatrix. That happened.
That's
I saw
strange.
This Muslim guy, and that's the thing. I mean, I really do think at the core of human sexuality on a biological level, there is this sort of odd dominance and submission thing. And maybe, you know, like we're saying about de Sade, there is a switch. But I think de Sade is a dominant person. And
I think in one of the stories, one of the girls grows a penis and then the guy sucks it. I forget. I think
wow.
That might be Juliet. I'm not so sure. But yeah, there is that reversing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but I think that the...
So you're not saying he's more dominant than Crowley was?
Yeah, I think that the dominant sexual person may have fantasies about being the submissive, but the submissive fantasies they have are always... submissive fantasies where they're still in control. Like when I went with this Muslim to this S&M bar and he was getting whipped, like he paid money to get whipped, you know, like he put himself in that situation. And it was like he was still in control. Even though he was getting whipped, he still volunteered to put himself there. It wasn't like in Salo where it's like, oh, I'm kidnapped. I'm just a poor Italian villager. What have you done to me? Oh, I just want to be with my... Oh, well, you know, okay, let's go further. So have you guys seen those Eli Roth Hostel films?
Yeah.
Have you seen Hostel 2?
I think I remember Hostel 2.
So Hostel 2 is different because
it's... Oh, is it the one where they get revenge?
No, Hostel 2 is where it's girls being thrown into the...
yeah, that's funny. Oh, yeah, okay, that's funny you say that.
Yeah, so Hostel 1 is where it's a bunch of American guys. Oh, we're, you know, Eli Roth is playing, you know, this sort of, we're the ugly Americans, like... I'm just going to go to Eastern Europe to get
cheap revenge for their conservative values.
Yeah, to get, but I mean, I almost kind of get it though. I almost kind of get that idea of I'm the exploiter. I just want innocent pussy from this.
But the point when it's girls, it turns to like, I mentioned this in, I remember I saw this really bad horror film last year. It was called Green Room.
Oh, the anti-Nazi movie. Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, we're Nazi punks. Fuck off. And they're like, and then the skinheads get them and they kill them all. But it's like, I don't know. I just think it's funny because it's implied to be, but at least they get what's coming.
Sure. But in Hostel 2, it's where it's girls go and they're sort of seduced into the situation. And I remember the scene where there's that Jewish woman who was from the Todd Solondz film, Welcome to the Dollhouse. Remember Wiener Dog? She's sort of this really ugly actress.
The one who plays, like, the girl in it?
Yeah, the main character. She's really ugly. She's, like, this female actress who always plays an awkward role in every movie. And, you know, she's sort of seduced, and this guy is like, oh, like, you know, I'll kiss you. And it's sort of like she's never been kissed or something. And then she's hung upside down naked. After she's
drugged. Yeah, I remember that, but I thought that was the first one.
No, that's in Hostel 2, where it's about the girls.
I think it's funny because it's like they'll kill guys in gruesome and disgusting ways, but when they do it with the women, it's like some artsy, sexy way. It's
like the old
1950s pulps. Like, if you look at the old like Nazi pulps where it's the beautiful blonde being like branded in the ass or something, it's like, oh, my ass, and I die. It's, I don't know, there's... It's like you can masturbate in the theater to like girls dying, and you wouldn't care. Yeah. Like guys, it's like ew. And then you're some weird Peter Sellers.
Well, sure. But what happens in this this sort of like awkward looking girl. She's, you know, this weird woman. She's tied upside down, and she's screaming for her mother. Oh, help me! I wish I was home, Mom. Help me! And then there's a woman in a bathtub, is sort of this beautiful-looking, older European woman with her sexual...
That's actually based on a...
Elizabeth Bathory, yeah. And she's sort of... She'd bathe in the blood of virgins, yeah. And she's sort of sitting there, and then they chop open this Jewess, and it... All the blood sort of goes upon this Elizabeth Bathory type, and... It's exactly what Pillier is saying, where it's this grotesque sexuality in that they're killing this virginal woman and it's her blood is being thrown on the body of this more sexually appealing woman. And that exploitation, it's a very bizarre exploitation, and it existed in the films, you know, it didn't, I mean, recently the pause has taken over and you don't see it as much, but...
I think a film like Hostel, it's a lot more disturbing than Salo. I think the only area where Salo is more controversial is because of the actors are implied to be, like, very young. I know in the original Desaad book, the characters were supposed to be, like, 12 or 15.
Yeah.
So that's probably the most controversial aspect of the film.
I don't know. It seems with little kids, it's like you're killing innocents. But with girls, it has something to do with sexuality. I mean, even in porn, it's like girls will, like, group sex and do bukkake and like get ejaculate. Something with the exchange of liquid is sexual, or something with body parts because of ownership or whatever. Maybe this weird collective. I said this before, where bukkake is this collective
nationalistic thing. Yeah, yeah.
And it's like the same in violence. It's like, okay, puts the virgin blood on this girl. The death is violence altogether. You're one with one another. Where it's like children, you kill their innocence before they grow up, but it's like this taking their youth away before they're ever. And I don't know. I just find that very interesting where it's just. But it's like you're at that point, you're almost like teasing with the offensive nature and just like. It turns into a like a White House song.
Where well, it's just like, yeah, I mean, see, but I think we're really on to somewhere really interesting here, where there is a total duality and there's two ideas, and one idea is cum, blood, and vomit for the pure act of exploitation. Look how disgusting this is. Look what human nature gives. And then on the other side of the spectrum, it is cum, blood, and violence, and whatever, and vomit, and that those fluids are, this is what we come from, our nation, this is who we are.
It's you know, like if you see a dead animal roadkill on the road, and then you look at it, and you realize, like, if you see the dead skunk, that's life, and then you start to look at its spleen. I don't know. Some people find that fascinating. I forget the photographer's name, but he takes pictures of dead animal roadkill.
Look at it. I remember having this strange interaction with an Asian ex-girlfriend of mine. I was walking down the side of the road, and I saw this deer had been hit by a car, and it had been left it there for days, and it was rotted completely. And I was, you know, I'm want to just walk on the side of the fucking road. Like, I'm nuts. Like, I would rather just walk for 2 hours sometimes and drive somewhere. And, you know, I do that. And I walked along the side of the highway, and I looked at this dead, decaying animal. And I looked at it, and I was disgusted at first. And then I realized that it was a biological organism. And that I was a biological organism.
Yeah, it's that deep.
And then I went and I told her about this, and she was just like, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it.
Death, both like, well, obviously human death, but even like animal suffering, like people eat meat, but they're removed from the whole like barbarism of like factory farming. So when people actually are exposed to death, it shocks people. And I think that's why there's a fascination with it in film, because people don't have to deal with it as much. For the most part, in real life.
Well, yeah, and I think there also is this kind of, you know, a lot of films are made by Jewish people, you know, and I think there is a kind of Jewish obsession with death, and I think you see that in the films of someone like Woody Allen, where, you know, if you read Henry Harpending's work, and, you know, you see the, you know, there's this sort of, you know, Jewish people have a pretty high IQ on average. I mean, it's an obvious thing, and I think people that have a high IQ are often people that are atheistic. I mean, some of them aren't, some of them are. And, you know, I think you see this in a lot of Jewish art, a kind of nihilism. You know, a high IQ, I think, can lead to atheism, and I think atheism can lead to nihilism. And I think you see this in, you know, a lot of Judaic art.
This might sound strange, but when I think of Woody Allen, I think of, like, two things. One, I think he, you know, his films are experimental, but at the same time, they're kind of like, like the beginning of romantic comedies in some artsy way. But at the same, you know, and at the same time, though, I think it's interesting that his wife is kind of Asian.
Yeah,
he's always had children about it, but he kept his children real secret.
Well, she was his originally a stepdaughter from Korea.
So yeah, that's the strange eccentric part, and I don't know about it, but I always think it's like his. I think always Woody Allen's known for those two things, where his eccentric romantic comedy films, which you now see flooded in IFC and Sundance, and maybe his relationship with Asians, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I do want to, like, touch on censorship. Peter Desaud was thrown in prison for his writings. Solo was banned in many countries like Australia. Not sure if it's still banned there today. Pilliter, you were telling me like about Will McBride and
Then
Peter Sotos, his work was
he mentioned
first person to be prosecuted for child pornography. Peter Sotos,
yeah.
You were telling me about this photographer Will McBride, who put up this series called Show Me, which was banned in the United States.
It's funny because I actually, from Peter Sotis's book, Selfish Little, he actually references, he has a whole chapter on Shobi, and his argument, Sotis's argument, is that people, underground criminals, would actually read the book and jerk off to McBride's photos. However, McBride, you have to remember, he's like this artsy, eccentric person where it's this, it's kind of like, oh, what's
well,
that?
Well, Shobi was a sex ed book.
Yeah.
It was published in Germany, but it had nude photos of children.
Yeah, and that's why the book got in trouble. It's like, it's for like a sex ed book for any generation, but at the same time, there's that, you're looking at the dead animal in the road where it's like, okay, these two kids, they're naked. Should they consent to sex, or can the kid even ejaculate, or is that girl can develop eggs? It's kind of this strange thing where, I think McBride, though, he means it, he wants that because, I think McBride, he wants to show the beauty of the body, going back to the whole Roman and Greek thing.
What McBride is known for, besides a Show Me, is he's done these books of of teenage boys in Germany. And they're controversial as well. And like you have these other photographers like David Hamilton and Jock Sturgis who do these nudes.
And Larry
what's
Clark.
What's the film? You're Not Alone. Who's the director for
that? Oh, Lasse Nielsen.
Lasse Nielsen. Gotcha.
And Larry, so Larry Clark also, right?
What's interesting about both like Lasse Nielsen's work and Will McBride, it kind of ties in with this whole sort of like alt-left theme. Because conservatives would be horrified by the themes of not only homosexuality, but the themes of like underage nudity. But also, there's like a strong Nordicist theme to both Lasse Nielsen's films and Will McBride's photography. In the sense, you see all these young, like blonde teenage boys, but there's also this sense of like a male bonding, which ties in with like Almera's theme of like the Männerbund.
But don't you see this in Larry Clark's work as well?
It's funny though. But I think Larry Clark comes more from the deconstructive edge, where it's like, oh yeah, this is what young kids do. And
when you look at thinkers like Larry Clark, who are probably anti-Western, I want to bring down the kind of white patriarchy, etc. What I'm saying is, or Harmony Korine, or any of these kind of deconstructionist, William Eggleston, whatever, these sort of artists, these deconstructionist artists, is as time goes on, when you look back at them, you can just find, this is white identitarian art. I don't give a shit what you thought you were doing, Larry Clark, but I don't care what you were trying to break down, but you made Tulsa in 1971? Like, yeah, maybe you said that the white family is being destroyed, drugs are taking over, violence is taking over, and you want to destroy white identity? Well, guess what you did, Larry Clark? You offered a dualistic approach. You offered another side to white identity. You didn't destroy white identity. You showed us the other side of it.
So with Larry Clark, he grew up in Oklahoma in the Midwest, and he moved to New York when he was young. And if you kind of contrast that with Lasse Nielsen, for say, they both deal with like adolescent sexuality. But Clark's work, like he has the film about the young hustlers in like Times Square in the 80s. And then he has the film Kids, which was very controversial. Those films deal with a lot of drug use, depravity, and also the film Kids is also in a kind of a multicultural setting. If you look at kind of like a Nielsen's films, they kind of portray more of a sense of innocence and like a utopian society. I don't think Nielsen had a political agenda, but he was just kind of portraying that society he lived in, which was like Denmark in the 1970s.
You know, I think there is some innocence, though, to Larry Clark, even though he, is angry about white patriarchy at all. One of his films, Impaled, is really about, he just has a film of this guy, this young kid who wants to get into porn, and he has a selection between five different women, and he chooses the older woman, and he just films him having sex with her. But the whole point of the film is basically this innocence where this guy just wants to have sex, but is it the right choice? And he's kind of making you feel as that it's horrifying. The same goes with Ken Park. That's another interesting film. Flirting with influence, where it's like, I think there's a quote somewhere. Larry Clark says, "You might think I'm a shock artist, but actually I'm a moralist." I think that's something very sympathetic about Clark. I mean, he also, it's on his Wikipedia page, but he went to jail for a bit because he got in a fight with someone about Israel. Of course, being pro-Jewish, you're pro-Israel. But the other guy said he was Palestinian, he hated the Zionist part, and they got in a fight. But even though ignoring his pro-Jewish stance, he was just being sympathetic and saying, well, they're trying to serve their own country. So there is this kind of sympathy to Clark, even though when it seems to and I guess he does have that weird pedophile nature when he likes little kids and he's now old, and it's kind of strange that he still has that.
Well, do you guys know, you know the streetwear company Fucked?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually, I have a Fucked sweater on right now, a hoodie. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, companies like Supreme and Fucked, they sort of come from that same kind of like we're of the street, we're subversive angle that Harmony Korine did or Larry Clark did. But when I look at this Fucked sweater, it has, you know, this guy with it's a skull and it has a Confederate flag bandana on it. And my other Fucked, I have some Fucked stuff. I really like that brand. I think they're really interesting. And Charles Kraft, who we've had on our show, who is a white nationalist and a Holocaust revisionist, he's done a lot of stuff with Fucked. And when I've looked into Eric Brunetti, who is the founder of Fucked, a streetwear brand that it's in that whole skatewear Supreme thing, I've seen Eric Brunetti has talked about AIPAC and globalism and all this sort of stuff. And in this election, he supports Jill Stein, but I don't really know if he does, because I know he's posted Donald Trump stuff. And the guy who runs Fucked Now, this guy J.R. Ewing, he's posted Make America Great Again stuff on his Instagram before. So I do think there is a and I know Brunetti has said, like, you know, I want to make art that's truly nihilistic. I when I make my streetwear, I want to make stuff that's really of the cutting edge. I don't want to stay within the mainstream. And I think that's the thing. It's like, there is a kind of artist that maybe was part of like a left-wing milieu, fuck the system thing, fuck Christianity, fuck my teachers, fuck the cops.
I mean, keep going forward. I always think of streetwear as being like sexy. This is kind of fun. I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Fuck everything, but you know, one streetwear I like is Illicit. It was like this old, I looked it from Juxtapose. It's basically this guy artist named Martin F. Edmund. He was like a New Zealand cartoonist. All his art is basically like rubber hose, Betty Boop stuff, but they look like they're gangsters or something. And it's really funny and sexy and cute. But it's like, it's not, I know the streetwear you're talking about, it's just like edgy and just like, it's like this white inner city urbanite culture.
Yeah.
And girlfriends and listen to noise music. But yeah, I think that's funny.
Yeah. I mean, did you say Asian girlfriends listen to noise music?
Back to what's
why were you tying in since Andy Bell from Eraser? What does he have to do with Solo?
No, it's because in Erasure, I really like Erasure. Andy Bell.
What do you think about that song a little more?
I love that song. I love that out. I love her. I can tell you about everything about Erasure, but you know, it's funny about Andy Bell. He's gay too, but like his lover was like 18 years older than him, and I always found that a little creepy. And I don't know. I just feel like, but he's like the bear and the twink thing, right? He's the one that takes it. I feel like, all right, he kind of role plays as that, like, I don't know. It's an interesting gay identity, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know. It just makes his character more interesting. I was just thinking of Andy Bell because of this whole with Pasolini, where it's like 10, 15 years younger guy, or, you know, I just think that's interesting. And in music, I often think of art a lot with music. And so Erasure is super innocent. I mean, especially Wonderland, the first album, is just like a little bunch of synth pop ditties and about how everything's going to be happy with a reunion and how, you know, like the one song you mentioned. I don't know. I'm thinking of other classic songs, but yeah.
I guess to sort of end this kind of thing, Can I go off on a tangent and talk about Sallow and some other films around the time and talk about fascism and communism? And I think it's a good ending point. It's about Sallow specifically.
Okay, go ahead.
One thing I think we should touch upon is a kind of conflict that occurs within Sallow. And it occurs within other films of the time as well. I know earlier on the show we were talking about Ani no Kurita, or In the Realm of the Senses, Nagisa Oshima's film from 1976. It's a Japanese film. But I also see this same thing in Paul Morrissey's films. He's an Andy Warhol acolyte, specifically Blood for Dracula and Flesh for Frankenstein, both of whom star Udo Kier and Joe D'Alessandro. And in these Andy Warhol films, and in the Nagisa Oshima film I mentioned, and in Pasolini's film Sallow, all of these films, you see a delineation between sex and violence, blood and cum, and communism and fascism. And I think there is a scene that occurs in Flesh for Frankenstein as well as Sallow, in which a man stands naked with his fist raised before he is shot.
Mm-hmm. I think.
What is this idea? You know, like Baudrillard, Jean Baudrillard, below, you know, he talks about this in Fatal Strategies a lot. You know, the revolution, the revolution, the revolution. And I think it's a very white, a very European idea of the kind of anti-bourgeois revolution, which has, I think, been taken over by third worldism in the 21st century. But I think in the 1960s and 1970s, there was sort of this European sort of rebellion against fascism. And I think both of these films have this sort of weird idea where it's the white man, white young man with a big cock holding his fist up after he commits a sexual act, being shot by fascists. The young communist with a big cock.
It's kind of humorous. Yeah. He's not having sex with them.
Yeah, I know. And I think it's sort of tragic in retrospect because it's almost like, you know, fuck your revolution. I know, you know, almost like it's us in the future, you know. Hey, your revolution's fucking stupid, man.
Well, imagine
more
if
like
that
us.
Was the first time he was ever going to have sex and then he gets shot. It's kind of another, I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
Hey, man, blood, cum, and vomit. It's all the same stuff.
Yes.
Well, that's a joke. But what do you think about that kind of theme or that idea?
I think that's interesting to affect. I mean, you're thinking the waving the fist in the air like it's some... And then he dies, like it's some kind of I'm trying to think what you're trying to say on that. I mean, what I think of it, going back to, is like if, because you're talking about the idea of like sex is power, you know, that's kind of a relatively new, you know, yeah. I think like Michel Foucault would often say like everything is a power discourse, even, and it's like
Foucault influenced by de Sade.
Yeah, and he died of AIDS because he was in power discourse clubs and he liked it, but at the same time, is sex really a power thing, or is it just this primal amoeba you just split and then you just do it like breathing or
something? I think it was Oscar Wilde who said everything is about sex except for sex, which is about power.
That's interesting, because it seems like we have this intention where sex is power, but you know, Tate says you're a tyrant in bed, but when is it like the truth when sex could be liberating? Like something Alfred Kinsey would say, when, you know, all he wanted to do was control sex in a healthy Western civ environment. So like there could be a brothel on every corner. So like you'd be in class and be like, Mrs. Smith, I have to go masturbate. Oh, go to the brothel right now and come back and do your homework. Like I'm saying,
This kind of ties back to the theme earlier in film, but in 70s films, in some ways, there was more like sexual freedom about what you could portray, especially like European cinema. In some ways, film has become degenerate, but there's all these rules about what you can show. Obviously, the biggest taboo in film is like underage nudity, but you can show any other form of degeneracy.
Yeah, that's so strange, and I think, you know, once again, SOTUS is really hitting hard on that and showing, like, where you, even the alt-right, you could, you know, it's funny, somebody DJs and picks their favorite records of what they want to hear, but not those records. And it just shows you the kind of the deep hypocrisy in that. I mean, when I think of sex, it's kind of, instead of thinking of this whole power thing, what if it really is this emotional, you know, if there's something I learned from Peter SOTUS, he talks of sex as, he even, I got to find it, I think he says this in Index, where he says, it's more like a habit, and people do these things because there's nothing else to do, and it's the only thing to be happy in a society which is, you know, you feel bad about. And there's some kind of liberal sense in there, and well, there's some pathological
altruism. That's interesting, but I mean, I think that Gavin McInnes makes an interesting point as far as this stuff goes. On his show, I've heard him say that when you have sex, it's almost like you're entering into a fourth dimension.
It is.
And it's kind of like, you know, whenever I have sex, I'm kind of like, you know, when I'm just hanging out, doing this podcast, and in the back of my head, I'm just like, oh, I should be fucking right now. You know, like you know, like, it's this thing. I'm like, oh, I should be fucking. Like,
I always joke, and I think maybe these, like, Woody Allen romance comedy films, you always have the main character, like, he'll go to college, he goes back to his dorm, and then he's with his hot, erotic, non-white girlfriend for 6 hours doing a cuddle party. Not exactly sex, but it's just like, is that what you do like 5-3 days of the week? Is just like, yeah, I don't know. And some people think that's like the whole bohemian lifestyle or some kind of pinnacle.
That's almost kind of like a Japanese, because there's this whole phenomenon in Japan where men like pay to cuddle with like teenage girls.
Yeah. Yeah, I know about that.
Well, what I want to say though is, like, you know, sex is like this crazy fourth dimensional thing where it's like, you know, there's been times where there's been girls who I found really, really, really sexually attractive, and I've been into them, and I've gotten to this point where, like, I've been in sexual circumstances with them, and, like, you know, I've thought about them, and I've been like, I want to have sex with them, and I do it, and as soon as I'm in that place, that plane, I'm thinking to myself, why am I doing this? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like,
what is this?
You do sex. It's like, I think there's good sex, bad sex, and then you just do sex. And both parties are like animals where it's like, I'm bored.
Let's have sex. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying, like, where you get to this sort of strange place where it's like, it's this thing that you desire so much that when you actually end up doing it, it's like, not it's desirable boring. At all. It's almost oddly boring enough.
And that's what I'm trying to say.
If you think about it, like, people devote their entire lives and, like, all their energies to it. It consumes all their emotional, psychological energy. It affects, like, all their decisions in life.
Yeah, and I think maybe this might sound kind of geeky, but the power of cuddle parties, where, you know, you have this New York things where it's like, we're all consenting adults, but we're not going to have sex. We're just going to get in our pajamas. We're going to have cuddle parties for until 2 a.m. or 4 a.m. And we're just going to sleep on top of each other because we need comfortable. Or it's the falling in love with the ideal of love, where people associate sex with ultimate love. But it's also at the same time this thing where it's like, you do sex just because you do sex. And then there's also amazing sex. Like, say you have sex with this beautiful Chinese girl in a car and on a sunny day at the beach.
We're at the end of the show. Solo is a really interesting film. I suggest go check it out. And thanks, Alex, and Pill Eater.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to talk to Pill Eater again in the future. I hope he becomes a consistent fixture on our show. I think he's someone who ideologically fits in with us, and hope to have him on more and more and more and more in the future.
Yes, I'm super excited. Also, if you're listening to this, go watch Sallow. It's a really good film, and it's something I'm about to go watch it again right now just to reference. But yep, talk to you then, Robert. Thanks, Alex.